and welcome to the Deep Dive Radio Show. As always, I'm your host, Nick Espinoza, and we're going to be talking about all things cybersecurity, cyber warfare, and technology related, and I think we're one of the only ones out there that's doing that right now. If you'd like to be part of the radio show in any way, shape, or form, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Nick AESP. Again, that's Nick AESP. Or you can send us an email to questions@securityfanatics.com. We have an action-packed show as always. There's always a lot to cover, so stick around with us as we deep dive into a topic and we catch up on everything else. So without further ado, let's begin. And we've got a great hour for you. We're going to be catching up on the news as always. Our breaches of the week, it's just kind of nuts and off the rails with some very, very serious breaches this week. And our deep dive of the week is going to be why we trust fake news. There is so much misinformation out there, and I think that there's a lot of foundational things in our society right now that make us susceptible to believing in fake news. So stick around. It's going to be a great hour. And as always, we're going to start with the news. And in app news, I think we really need to basically ask ourselves the questions, are we using too many apps? And the reason why is because of this news from a company called DataVisor. They ran research on this and they found some rather interesting things here. Now, according to their research, 65% of accounts, like basically online accounts that have experienced an account takeover attack, and I'll explain that in a minute, are from apps that haven't been accessed for more than 90 days. In other words, these are dormant apps, dead apps, apps that we have downloaded, installed, and then thought, I'm done. Maybe it's a game, maybe it's a productivity app that we didn't like ultimately, but this is a serious problem. Now, an account takeover attack is simply this. If I am, like, let's say looking in the dark web, I have the ability to download tons of usernames and passwords that have been out of various data breaches, and then I'm going to go ahead and try to log in to various organizations with that. Now, in terms of this, it's also called credential surfing. I'll try to log into every bank, every social media, and all of this. But I can look at these apps and try to log into the various apps using a username and password that, let's say, you use commonly, and by virtue of it, take over your account. So maybe I'm getting information from there. Maybe it's a game where you actually have a whole bunch of points, but you don't play it anymore. Now maybe I can transfer those points to my character, or, you know, all this kind of stuff, or maybe hold that account for ransom if I think you're using it. But if the majority of these are over 90 days, that basically shows us that, one, we need better password and security control. In other words, don't use the same password for everything. You guys have heard me talk about that, you know, for quite some time. But more to the point is that we need to really start looking at, you know, what we're doing, how we're using these apps, if we really need them in our lives. You know, I mean, if you have kids or kids that, let's say, are at the age where they're, you know, they're preteen, teenager, and they're using phones, they download flipping everything, without actually looking at this, validating and all of that. And that's a whole, I could go on to a whole segment on parents, how you need to control those apps and validate them and research the companies and all of that. But the point is that, you know, if you're looking at that, you know, the kid's going to download 100 different apps. They're only going to play one or two because they're trying, failing, or their friends are like, oh, we're trying this, and next week we're trying something else. Well, we're putting our information out there continuously on stuff that we're not using or you know, really actively there, and that's getting us in trouble. And if 65%, literally two-thirds of these accounts attacks are takeover attacks from this, that's a serious problem. So that is your news. That's your app news of the week. And please make sure that you're using good passwords and you're only downloading really what you need. And most people don't need 700 apps. You know what I mean? You can clean that up a bit, or just make sure you're policing it as you're going along. So that is your app news of the week. And in automation news, this is, I think, rather fascinating because it's something that we're going to have to address in society overall. I could literally do a deep dive on this, I think. Now, basically, I think automation in many ways makes things like airplanes, which is what we're going to be talking about, safer and more efficient. But when we are looking at the 737 MAX from Boeing and two crashes, I'm wondering if there's more of a flip side to this. Now, here's the thing. While advanced autopilot and computers are now considered an integral part to any modern jetliner, many pilots worry that the systems are detracting from developing and maintaining their own abilities, meaning pilots are less educated, pilots are less experienced because the planes are doing more of the work and what happens in an emergency situation. And so I think this is a very interesting quote from Les Westbrooks. He's an associate professor at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University, and he basically said this after the last 737 MAX crash, which was Ethiopian Airlines back in March. And I quote, "We've been talking about this in the industry for years. Pilots are losing their basic flying skills, and there's an over-reliance on automation." And I think that's true. And so if I'm looking at this, I kind of want somebody that's, you know, got 20 plus years experience, because if we need to make a judgment call, a lot of times the automation, you know, maybe they're not making the right one. Maybe they're taking a safer road, which actually ends up being more dangerous than, let's say, an initial risk. Maybe it's not looking at that out. Not to mention the fact that even if we have pilots, you know, let's say up there in the plane, and the automation fails in some way, they're going to have to take over. And if they're inexperienced, that's a very serious problem. And so could automation literally be detrimental in this respect to society, in the sense that we are losing that ability to educate, we are losing that experience that we need, you know, and all of that. And so there you go. I mean, would you trust yourself completely to an automated plane, you know, given that it's layers and layers of programming and all this kind of stuff? Or if the plane is mostly automated, would you want an experienced pilot? Or are you completely fine with this? Am I blowing up, you know, this for no reason, and you're saying, shut up, Nick, you know, it's going to be totally fine? I mean, we've seen issues with the driverless cars as well, where, you know, they've screwed up and crashed into things, killing people and all of that. It's very rare, but it does happen. We are still honing that ability. So I think it's a question we need to ask. And I think it's something that, you know, I think is interesting in the news, because when we are looking at automation, I think that especially when we're talking about hundreds of people on something like a 737 MAX, it is something that we need to address. And so that is your automation news of the week. And in China hacking news, and it's not really hacking, it's just fascinating. So I think this is obviously something that a lot of you guys would disagree with, myself included. But basically, researchers found that China, at least on their western borders, if you were entering the country either as an immigrant or a tourist or whatever that is, the Chinese were either knowingly or unknowingly inserting malware into your mobile phone so that it could basically scrape and collect all of your data and transfer it to China. Now, the logic that China's using for this, and again, they're an authoritarian regime, they don't have the same checks and balances on privacy that we do, but their logic here is that they are basically looking for Islamic extremists. Now, China right now has been oppressing a couple of different groups within their borders, including the Uyghurs and some others, but they are looking for Islamic content on mobile phones to basically see if this person would be viable to enter into the country. Now, we have seen, and I've talked about this in other news segments and all of that, the United States basically not wanting to insert malware to data scrape, but they do want you to turn over social media accounts if you're immigrating to the United States so that they can check to make sure you're not part of the Death to America crowd and all of that. But the Chinese are taking it one step further. We already know they have a massive surveillance state, but would you willingly give your phone to travel to China and say, okay, here's my phone, go ahead and insert malware onto that? I mean, the mere fact that after you leave the country, let's say you're a tourist, you go, you come back, you know, the malware is still going to be there. And you might be able to wipe your phone or try to delete it, and it might be persistent. And then anything you do, any future emails, contacts, all of that continues to phone home to the Chinese government. I've written articles on the massive amount of data mining the Chinese government is doing outside of their borders in countries like the United States and Europe. But this is taking it to, I think, a different level, especially if you're simply just, you know, entering the country, you know, for one thing or the other. You know, and what if you're, let's say, you know, a Muslim coming from the United States? Are they going to do that to you as well? Or is it purely people that they consider a threat? And eventually, at what point, when does it evolve into just those people they're specifically targeting to virtually anybody that is coming through? You connect to the Wi-Fi, they're immediately injecting you with, you know, with infections. You connect to the cellular connection, it could be the exact same thing. So we're going to see where this goes. But I think it's an absolutely fundamental issue that we need to discuss and talk about here. But it's a serious problem that we're seeing coming out of China. And so that is your Chinese hacking, for lack of a better term, news of the week. You're listening to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show on Huntley Community Radio, WHRULP, on 101.5 FM. And in cyber warfare news, this is actually interesting because Congress, specifically Congressional Oversight, is looking for the Trump administration to basically release secret directives that they have given the Pentagon, basically the Department of Defense or the U.S. military, on basically ramping up offensive cyber warfare. Now, the Congressional Oversight Committee for Intelligence believes that the military is taking a more active role in offensive cyber weaponry against countries like Iran, North Korea, et cetera, and they want to know. And I think this is actually an important news item in the sense that if we are looking at, the military, one of the things or one of the ways, rather, that our military is structured is that, one, the commander in chief is technically a civilian, not in the military. It's the president of the United States. But two, that our other governing branch of body, the U.S. Congress, has the ability to have civilian oversight of the military. And this is something that is not happening right now. So the Pentagon is getting directives or rather, presidential executive orders to basically say, ramp up cyber warfare. At least that's the assumption. And they're not reporting this to Congress. Congress is not aware of this, even though Congress has the clearance to know this. And so I think this is very interesting because we may actually see a fight between the executive and legislative branch of the U.S. government over this particular issue. And in the meantime, the military is taking their orders from their commander in chief and doing what they're supposed to do. And so I think this is going to be a very interesting topic because it seems like in many ways, President Trump, being the president of the United States, has the right to issue executive orders to the military. But at the same token, the president is limited with what he can do with the military. In other words, without a declaration of war from Congress, for example, the president can only have execute a military action or a police action for something like up to 90 days. And so this becomes an important check on executive power when it comes to executing the military. In other words, we wouldn't want the president to go ahead and use the military to, let's say, shut down the other branches of Congress and declare himself a dictator. I'm not saying that's happening in this situation. Please don't misunderstand me. I'm simply talking about the directives for cyber offensive weaponry. But that's one of the logics behind the check on the president's power when it comes to ordering or issuing orders to the military. So we're going to see where this goes. But I think it's a very important topic that we're going to see unfold. And as I continue to read on these things, I'm going to let you know if this goes anywhere, rather. So that is your cyber warfare news of the week. And in vulnerability news, I don't know if you guys know who D-Link is. I'm sure some of you are actually running their equipment, like their routers and their wireless access points and all of that. In business, we typically want to stay away from products like D-Link. They're very basic and they tend to have vulnerabilities. And now we have confirmation of this. Now, D-Link has agreed to implement a quote-unquote comprehensive software security program to settle a federal trade or FTC commission charge that the company exposed customer data to hackers while advertising top-of-the-line security measures. So if you saw D-Link ads, they'd say, oh, our equipment is secure, blah, 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 blah. Now, D-Link will not actually pay any financial penalties as part of this settlement, but its manufacturing process will have to include threat modeling, tests for security bugs prior to the product's release, ongoing device monitoring to address flaws, automatic firmware updates, and the acceptance of vulnerability reports from researchers. So when researchers find vulnerability reports and they submit them to D-Link, D-Link must accept them. That entire list is pretty much the default for what most manufacturers do. And the fact that D-Link wasn't doing that is a very serious flaw. Odds are, if you're running a D-Link product, it has some vulnerabilities that hackers can just pretty much get right around or blow right through. So heads up to you if you're running D-Links, make sure they're completely up to date. And at some point when you need new equipment, hopefully sooner than later, aka go out today, you should probably replace that with a better brand. So that is your manufacturing/D-Link news of the week. And in your federal law enforcement news of the week, we are talking about the FBI. Now, I think this is absolutely fascinating. On July 12th, they had a request for proposal, an RFP. Now, a lot of this reporting comes from various news sources, but my notes are mostly from Engadget here. Now, according to this RFP, the FBI is looking for a quote-unquote early alerting tool that would help it monitor terrorist groups, domestic threats, criminal activity, and on and on and on. Now, the tool, at least what the FBI is looking for, the tool would provide the FBI with access to the full social media profiles of people of interest. Now, this could include information like users' IDs, email addresses, IP addresses, meaning where they are, telephone numbers, etc. The tool would also allow the FBI to track people based on location, enable persistent keyword monitoring, and provide access to personal social media history. Now, what makes this interesting is that according to the RFP, and I quote, the mission critical exploitation of social media will enable the Bureau to detect, disrupt, and investigate an ever-growing diverse range of threats to U.S. national interests. Now, they don't exactly have the best track record when it comes to, when it comes to not surveilling the citizens. Now, earlier this year, the ACLU, or the American Civil Liberties Union, sued the government over its use of social media. Basically, they were surveilling immigrants. Now, the Trump administration has also proposed allowing officials to basically get into social media accounts of Social Security disability recipients to see if they're actually faking it. In other words, if you're on disability and, you know, you've got Facebook posts of, oh, here's me skydiving or playing basketball or something, clearly you're not disabled. Obviously, a good chunk of fraud goes on in these kinds of things. But overwhelmingly, people on disability are going to have some kind of disability. So it's interesting. And if we're looking at the history of this, we already know that social media is tied directly into U.S. government surveillance. So we're talking about like Google and Facebook and all of that. When Edward Snowden released all of those documents a few years back, one of the programs was called Prism that we became aware of. And now it has been confirmed that basically these major internet companies in the United States have deep ties to the intelligence agency within the United States to basically monitor, track, and all of this. Now, I don't think anybody is looking at this and saying, okay, we shouldn't have an FBI or we shouldn't give them the ability to actually hunt down, terrorists or those that want to do harm to other people. I think that's what they're there for and that's needed. But how do we balance that with safeguarding, information? So, for example, let's say on my personal Facebook account, I'm posting articles about ISIS, not necessarily pro-ISIS, but let's say I'm having the debate on social media on ISIS or Al-Qaeda or something else. Does that automatically get me flagged? Do I get put into some kind of database even though I have no association with them whatsoever? I mean, these are the kinds of things that we have to think about. And when you are signing an end user license agreement for something like a Facebook, you're basically kind of giving them the right to do this, not to mention data mine the bejesus out of you for advertising purposes, which is what Facebook does to drive their revenue, but on and on. So that's the question. I think it's a valid one. Can we look at this kind of tool and say, how are we going to give it oversight? Otherwise, the FBI could literally do this for anybody at will. And we know these internal companies have the ability to do this at will themselves anyway, and let third-party developers do it, as been seen over and over by Facebook, Google, and on. So we're going to see where this goes. But I think it's a very important question that we need to ask ourselves. And that is your law enforcement news of the week. And in screen time use, let's just call it that, that kind of news. For the first time ever, U.S. consumers will spend more time using their mobile devices than watching TV. Now, smartphone use is dominating this time. And so breaking it down by the numbers, I think it's absolutely fascinating. The average U.S. adult will spend 3 hours and 43 minutes on mobile devices in 2019, which is just above the 3 hours and 35 minutes spent on television. And if you're looking at those two things combined, we're talking about over 7 hours spent between mobile phones and in front of TVs. Now, of time spent on mobile devices, U.S. consumers will spend 2 hours and 55 minutes on smartphones, a 9-minute increase from last year. And in 2018, mobile time spent was 3 hours and 35 minutes, with TV beating it out at 3 hours and 44 minutes. Now, it's interesting because if we're looking at these predictions, consumer use of smartphone will continue to make up the majority of their media consumption, but the prediction is that they will basically plateau by 2020 as consumers become increasingly uneasy about the overuse of mobile devices. We've seen a lot of medical articles on this about, are we shifting who we are in terms of bodies and muscle use? Are we spending too much time, attached to a screen than we are just going outside and taking a walk, that kind of thing. And so the question really is, are we addicted to technology? And if we are, what's the long-term ramifications for our health and society? We are continuing to see this. And if we are looking at a 24-hour period, let's assume you're spending 6 to 8 hours asleep, which leaves us, about 18 hours or so. And of those 18 hours, we're spending, would say 7 of those hours, roughly, just a little more, on a smartphone, a TV, a tablet, whatever that is, you know, then we're spending 8 hours at work. We are spending maybe, 1 to 2 hours or so not interacting with that. And that doesn't even mean that we don't have a radio going or, you know, music playing in the background or something along those lines. But we are dominating a huge amount of our time on technology. And what is that going to look like? You know, I mean, if you have kids, you know how hard it is to get them off the phone, to get them off the tablet, to get them off the television or the Xbox or the Netflix or whatever it is. How do we combat that? Is that good? Is that fine? You know, if the games are educational and they're learning something about it, is that acceptable use versus just sitting there watching a TV show? I mean, I think these are questions that we have to ask because the long-term ramifications of globally, the billions of people that are using the internet and interacting with these devices, I think it's something we need to talk about. So that is your, I guess, screen time news of the week. And I'm curious to know your thoughts on that one. And now for breaches of the week. And if you have a data breach to report that's local to you or the major news might have missed it, please, by all means, send it to me. And I'm glad to give you a shout out and include it in the radio show and possibly a daily video. And you can find me on Twitter and Facebook at Nick AESP. Again, that's Nick AESP. Or you can email questions at securityfanatics.com. Again, that's questions at securityfanatics.com. And I'm more than happy to include your data breach and give you a shout out on the air. With that, let's begin. And this week's Breaches of the Week, in part, comes from listeners and some viewers for my weekly Breaches of the Week viewers. And I just want to give a shout out to you guys, Chris Fowlon, Dr. Christopher Gay, Rebecca Rutherford, Deepak Gupta. Guys, thank you very much for sending me information periodically throughout the last couple of weeks, various breaches you stumbled across in your own news reading and all of that. And if you're listening to this and you have information on this, please feel free to hit me up at any one of my social media accounts on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, YouTube, SoundCloud, MeWe, take your pick. I even now have a BitChute account, which I've just recently learned about that replicates all my YouTube videos over there. So anywhere, feel free to send me some kind of shout out or anything with what you find. But guys, thank you very much. And with that, let's dive right in. And we are starting in Maryland with the Department of Labor. Now, 78,000 customers basically had their information accessed by an unauthorized party. We're talking about names, social security numbers, date of birth, your county or city of residence was some of the information that was accessed. But interestingly enough, the way the database was leaked, it was only specific years of time that were accessed. So if you have anything to do with the Maryland Department of Labor in the years 2009, 2010, 2013, or 2014, heads up, you may be one of the 78,000 people that just got exposed in their database. That's kind of odd, but I'm guessing it's how their data is structured that pretty much put it there. So that, again, is Maryland's Department of Labor. Moving on, we're going to be talking about a charity called St. John Ambulance. Now, they just suffered a ransomware attack, and they say they resolved it in half an hour. And guys, that's a great remediation time, so hopefully it wasn't hit. But to be basically taking precautions, they're saying that anybody that has anything to do with St. John Ambulance, in other words, if you've signed up for them, signed up for like newsletters, if you've attended a meeting, maybe you've booked a course through them, all of this prior to February of 2019, which was when they discovered this breach, heads up, you might want to make sure that your information is secure because St. John's Ambulance may have just gotten it exposed for you. Moving on, we're actually going to be talking about a rather serious one. And this comes from the Miami Police Department. Now, 1 terabyte, which is quite a bit of data, of body cam video, meaning those are the body cams that the police wear when they're interacting with the public to record the incident. It's there to both protect the public as well as the police. Those were leaked and stored in unprotected internet databases. But what makes this really damning is that the researchers, when they were looking into this, found that a lot of this information, these body cam videos, were actually sold on the dark web. And so, and I quote from the researchers, besides Miami police, there is body cam videos from police departments leaking all over the United States. So basically, I know there's a couple of different systems that have body cam out there. I know one of them basically gives you body cams and, like, I think it's something like a free year of storage if you're a police department for this, where they give the cameras away, but then you have to pay for the storage, whatever that is. That might be one of the systems that is insecure. I'm not naming names primarily because I, you know, again, I don't know if it's them, but that's a very serious problem because these are obviously, a lot of these are confidential, especially if you're, you know, potentially being arrested for something. You wouldn't want that out there. Moving on, we're actually going to be sticking in Florida for a while, and we're heading to Sarasota, Florida. Now, this is an interesting one. The sheriff in Sarasota is investigating a statewide data breach. Now, apparently, a Miami employee of the Florida Department of Family and Child Services is being accused of leaking basically people's data to six other people in what ended up being a fraud scheme that made purchases. They created a fraud ring with information of Floridians that use the Department of Family and Child Services. Now, this breach affected roughly 2,000 Floridians across the state, and it actually has about $260,000 in retail theft purchases. So in other words, they were leaking the information, and then basically people were buying stuff with the stolen information. And the Sarasota, Florida sheriff that's investigating this expects those numbers to rise as they uncover more. But right now we've got this employee plus six people plus $260,000 in retail theft. So if you are in Florida and for whatever reason you are attached to the Department of Family and Child Services in your state, heads up to you, you may have been affected. Moving on, we're actually going to be talking about a company called Orvibo. That's O-R-V-I-B-O. Now, this is a Chinese-based company, and they do home and business solutions for smart automation. So they do things like manage energy or have security things. They can manage your HVAC, HVAC controls, and all of this. And you know where I'm going with this. More than 2 billion user logs were exposed due to an insecure database. And we're talking about every kind of data from email addresses, which are your logins, passwords, user locations, conversations that were recorded by smart devices, reset codes to get into accounts, addresses, and on and on and on and on. In other words, if you have Orvibo for your home or your business and you're in their ecosystem, heads up, everything about you and your account just got exposed. That's a major, major problem there. Again, Orvibo. And stay tuned to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show as we take a quick break for a public service announcement. We'll be back right after that.